Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, Emmett here. If you were listening last week, you'll know that we will be hosting our first ever Stock Club Live podcast in less than 2 weeks' time. The gang and I will be taking to the stage at Dublin's Herbert Park Hotel on the evening of Wednesday, November 23rd, where we will look back on the roller coaster that was 2022 and make some of our predictions for what 2023 will bring, including picking some of the stocks that we think are set to thrive next year. I can't wait for it. It's going to be a great night and a first for Stock Club. Tickets are just €20, which includes a couple of free drinks at the bar. There are just a handful of seats remaining, so don't miss out. Bring a friend or two and get a head start on the market for 2023. Just click on the link in the podcast description to book your tickets now. See you on the 23rd.
Hi there and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. I'm Mike, and joining me on today's episode are Rory and Anne-Marie from the My Wall Street analyst team. This week, we're talking about the circus that is Twitter right now, the state of the ride-hailing industry, and we discuss whether people are prioritizing their Netflix subscriptions over food. Right, lads, I know we're at risk of talking about the same thing every week on this show, but I don't think we can't mention Elon Musk and Twitter and the absolute hit show, we'll call it, or a cluster duck, whichever you prefer.
Rory, that's a new one.
Well, we can't curse on this show. I remember it was like my second podcast. No, like there's an Apple thing about it. James said I had to go re-record like a sentence where I cursed.
There's not.
Yeah,
he's lying to you. Yeah. No, it is because we have like a family friendly rating, and if we curse on it, we lose the family friendly rating, and it's like not good for your promotion on the podcast app.
Yeah.
Okay. God, what's my language going for
it? Well, you seem pretty good so far, anyways. Rory, Amory, did you think it could go this far south this quick with Twitter?
I was on holidays during the whole thing, so I kind of just tried my best to ignore it, to be honest. It was happening so fast, it was hard to kind of cling on to any one thing. I do like now that having started his Twitter ownership with the bird is free and free speech is back on the platform, that he's begun permabanning anyone who like pretends to be him.
Yeah, just makes fun of him in general.
Yeah, I also saw at some point last night, I think they stopped or they prevented people from changing their names for some reason. And someone with the handle Elon Musk fondles dogs complained.
Oh, there goes the family finally rating. We just lost it right there.
Just when we had it.
Oh, dear. My favorite part was when they started laying people off, and then the next day they started calling people up going, I'm sorry, we didn't realize how valuable you were to the company. Can you come back? Because we can't run this without you. That was pretty bad.
Yeah, it's not a good look, is it?
I feel like Elon is getting a very quick tutorial in how difficult social media actually is. And,
yeah.
You know, like for all the, like everyone, you know, who's on Twitter or any social media account constantly complains about, you know, oh, it doesn't do this and I wish it could do that and why don't they stop this? It's just really difficult. Like, it's just not an easy thing to kind of, you know, get all those cats to walk in a row. You know, they're just, people are mad and people do mad things when they're kind of unleashed on the world in the form that social media has taken, and trying to corral them all to behave is just a really difficult endeavor. One that I don't think many people would take on, especially when it's going to cost them $44 billion.
Yeah, it's like a lesson for armchair experts and backseat drivers everywhere. Just, you know, let people do what they're doing.
Yeah,
I suppose Elon also has a bit of a habit of, he really likes to go things alone. Like, I think like SpaceX and Tesla, he's kind of pushed out other people. Like, you know, even like the original Tesla founders, he kind of pushed them out. And like, when you're so reliant on advertising, that's not really the way you can go. Like, you can't push out every other company that maybe wants to advertise on you, because 90% of Twitter's revenue is advertising, and now pretty much every major brand in the United States said, oh, we're pausing all of our Twitter spending. So oh, it's not great. Like, he's not really suited to the job, to be honest.
No.
It's kind of like if you had, if someone who was really good at fantasy football decided that they want...
Give him the United job.
You know, yeah, or, you know, decided they wanted to, like, you know, be the head coach of, like, the Denver Broncos. They just are like, I'm really good at this, you know, I like, and he probably thinks he is really good at it because he's got all these followers and people respond to him. He's like, I can fix this. Like,
this is so easy.
This is so easy. Why don't they just do what I say, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure, I mean, that's the experience of pretty much every sports fan in the world. I mean, if you ever go to a pub in Dublin, you'll just see countless, usually overweight men screaming at the, you know, the best athletes in the world. Why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that?
Oh, absolutely. Christy Moore picking the team. On a kind of more serious note, I suppose it's always fun to make fun of Elon Musk, but for a Tesla shareholder, you got to be pretty concerned at the minute. I think was it just today he sold off a bunch of shares?
Yeah, $4 billion worth sold today.
Yeah, just the casual $4 billion here and there.
Yeah, you know, throw it around.
Yeah.
But I suppose, like, so much of Tesla's valuation over the years has been just revolved around the cult of Elon and his personality. And, you know, maybe this is just, is there a kind of sheen coming off the cult of Elon? Or, because he seemed to always be this bonkers. Like, has he become more bonkers recently?
More publicly bonkers, maybe.
Yeah, I was just about to say, it was because he's now so connected to Twitter, I think he's become more active on Twitter, which gives him more of a public platform to appear bonkers. I think that's kind of what's happened.
Mm. This also, doesn't he have like a thing where his lawyers have to vet every tweet, or is that gone? Like, that was fully a thing there for a while. They're not doing their jobs.
I think he applied to a judge recently to try and get that waived. I think they told him no, because that was part of a deal with the SEC.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know. That'd be hilarious. God, what a job.
They're going to be busy. Jesus.
His lawyer probably has a chair in the content moderatorship part of Twitter, and they just sat him there, and he said, you stay there.
Yeah.
And I'll come back anytime I want to think about something.
Oh, yeah. An absolute mess. But we can't stay on Twitter for too long. So
anyway, we don't have to talk about it anymore. It's not a public company. We just,
exactly.
Yeah.
It's off our plates, which is nice.
Yeah. So moving on to two companies who have never done anything wrong. Uber and Lyft. So Lyft reported earnings earlier this week, and it was a bit of a mixed bag. The stock fell about 20% on Tuesday after Wedbush analyst Dan Ives called a modest disappointment. I'd hate to see what would have happened if it really messed up, but the drop can be put down to a miss on revenue, but maybe more so falling short of the standards Uber set the week before when it performed really well. Rory, for two businesses that have kind of been intrinsically linked for so long, are we starting to see them diverge? Would you agree with the market here that Uber is kind of the much stronger business compared to Lyft?
I probably think it's always been clear that Uber was the stronger business. I mean, if you're looking kind of purely at the kind of key operating metrics that you would tend to look at, you know, it always had the clear first mover advantage in the space. I think Uber started about 2-3 years before Lyft. It always had more users. It always had more drivers. It always had higher revenue. It always had bigger market share. Lyft's kind of play was that it was, you know, the kind of soft Uber. It kind of marketed itself as like this Uber with a conscience. Whether it was or not, it kind of for debate, but they kind of definitely put themselves out there as, you know, being more in tune with drivers, treat like paying them better, being kind of safer for passengers. In fact, I was listening to an interview with Karis Fisher, the famous tech journalist, a few years ago, and she was saying that, like, when she first met the founders of Lyft, she was like, they're such nice guys, you know, they're really thoughtful. And they said, like, Travis is going to destroy them. referring to Travis Kalanick, who's Uber's founder, CEO, and all around piece of work.
All around bad, bad person.
Yeah. And at one point, you know, Travis actually tried to buy out Lyft, but the founders turned them down. So Kalanick went on this real kind of Zuckerberg Snapchat destroy at all costs projects. And in fact, like, there certainly was a moment, I think around 2016, when it did look like Uber had kind of won the rivalry. Lyft really wasn't able to compete in terms of like the marketing spend or the promotions. Uber basically like completely slashed its rates, totally subsidized their drivers. Lyft wasn't able to follow suit. And At one point, they only had kind of 4 months worth of cash left. But Uber survived. They ended up going public before Uber. I think Lyft's management would tell you that that was all down to their strategy, which was certainly kind of more focused than Uber's. You know, they didn't get involved in helicopters and businesses in Vietnam and AI and growth at all costs. That kind of takes away from what was a really, I mean, utterly disastrous 2017 that Uber really inflicted upon itself. To list all the missteps they took around that time would be a fool's errand, but you know, highlights include Kalanick joining newly elected President Trump's advisory council. Then they lifted surge pricing during this protest over said president's travel ban. That started an online protest that reportedly led to 500,000 users deleting app. There were sexual harassment allegations. There was a video of Kalanick arguing at the driver. You know, it just went on and on. And suddenly Lyft were back in the game, this kind of alternative to the kind of toxic culture that was festering under Kalanick's leadership. And obviously now, you know, the new CEO at the helm, and he's much more kind of user-friendly, let's say, PR-wise.
It's a nice way of putting it, yeah.
But it does seem like we've kind of cut to this point now where Uber seems to be, you know, getting its edge back, and Lyft does seem to be very much falling behind.
So then with the two earnings reports and questions, where was the divergence? What's Uber doing that Lyft just isn't?
I wouldn't say either company had outstanding results. Uber certainly were much stronger than Lyft. It's kind of become apparent now that Uber is edging much closer to profitability than Lyft, which, you know, wouldn't necessarily be the case given the relative size of both these businesses. And just because you're bringing in more revenue doesn't mean that you're going to be able to turn a profit any faster than a company that's bringing in less. But it does seem to be the case when you look at these kind of earnings side by side and you kind of look at the momentum of these two businesses over the last kind of couple of months. Uber is kind of strong, showing, you know, pretty strong momentum in revenue growth. It was up 73% year over year in the last report. That's certainly helping kind of further down the line in terms of adjusted EBITDA and free cash flow. A note adjusted there. They're seeing kind of stronger demand, both in terms of kind of new drivers and new riders. Their bookings were up 26%, users were up 14%, requests were up 19%. And it really doesn't look like that demand is slowing despite the sort of macroeconomic headwinds that we've heard pretty much every management team talk about over the course of this earnings season. In fact, Uber management seems kind of upbeat about the coming quarter and kind of return to travel and return to, you know, office culture and stuff is helping that. On the other hand, you know, Lyft's really kind of hasn't really recovered from the pandemic at all. It's growing much slower. The net revenues for the company were only up 22%. You know, compare that with over 70% for Uber. And you know, that's a huge divergence even before you consider the kind of law of large numbers. You would think Uber at this point would be growing a lot slower. Their riders are only growing by 7%. Their total rides grew by 10% over the quarter. So it does seem that, like, there was, I suppose, the pandemic obviously caused serious concern for both these businesses. Largely because, you know, they couldn't operate for several quarters, just total lockdown across a lot of the places that they operate. And then there was this kind of very slow rollout of people getting back into the ride sharing thing. Uber seems to have kind of recovered, bounced back quite strongly. Lyft, for some other reason, just seems to have kind of fallen out of people's consciousness. And you know, that could come down to marketing spend. It could come down to just, you know, the size of Uber and the fact that it's just kind of more prominent in people's minds. Also, you know, more drivers you have now, you know, when you get into a situation that we have been seeing where there's a kind of pent up demand and less supply, obviously it's going to take a lot longer for you to get a Lyft driver than it is to get an Uber driver, given the fact that they have a bigger kind of network.
So zooming out then, like last month, Department of Labor unveiled a proposal that it would make it harder for companies to treat workers as independent contractors. Obviously, Uber and Lyft drivers and delivery drivers are all independent contractors. It's kind of what the business is based on. What are the kind of implications here, or what do people see, I suppose, as the success of this bill?
You know, it's always hard to comment when it comes to changes in American legislation. We talked about this beforehand with companies like MasterCard and Visa. There always seems to be some sort of legislative push on something in America. The problem is that there's obviously a huge lobbying industry there that holds a huge amount of sway, more so than any other democracy. And money talks. These companies have a lot of it. They're willing to spend it to protect their interests. You know, we saw that 2 years ago when Uber, Lyft, DoorDash and others pretty much pumped, you know, millions of dollars into a proposition in California to fight essentially what this effort is by the Department of Labor, very similar proposal. And Derek Khosrowshahi, you know, the CEO and the squeaky clean face of Uber, was out promising that this was going to be great for drivers. It was actually going to improve their take-home pay and their benefits and all this. All total twaddle, of course. You know, studies have shown that drivers are much worse off since that proposal passed, despite the California Supreme Court actually intervening on some of the measures, but they're still way worse off. Now, the Department of Labor is looking to reclassify all drivers and employees. Both Uber and Lyft have said that they expected such measures and that it won't impact their business models. Again, that sounds like rubbish to me. If it wasn't going to impact your business model, why'd you spend so much on Proposition 20? But maybe they believe that it's not going to go through. You know, if it does, it is going to massively increase costs, which they'll have to pass on to consumers. And maybe they think that they're kind of embedded enough in the transport ecosystem that consumers are going to kind of stick around. Or maybe they just know the chance of the proposals going through the way they're set out now is pretty unlikely.
Yeah, you kind of touched on something there. I want to ask maybe a bigger question. You had a great quote way back when where Uber sold us this lie that you could have a personal chauffeur for however much money. And, you know, it was built on VC money and whatever else. And I think that exposed a lot of the ride hailing industry, the delivery industry. It was like, this is cheaper than it should be. And that's how they grew. Like, what are your thoughts on that industry as a whole? Do you think they're truly viable economic models, or do you think it might come crashing down soon? Or as you said, do you think Uber and Lyft have, and ride hailing as a whole, has kind of established itself enough as just this modern infrastructure aspect, I suppose?
I mean, it's a model that can work. Well, first of all, it's a model that can work in a monopoly, you know, very well, because then you don't have to compete constantly with pricing for consumers and drivers. You know, it's not that these companies necessarily lack economic moats, but it's maybe that a lot of the economic moats that we look for when looking for an investment aren't quite as strong as some people think they are. So, you know, you could argue that Uber has a strong brand. And if you think about a strong brand as simply a brand that people recognize, then I would agree with you. But when we look at brand through the lens of economic moats, what we want to see is that brand strength translate into something more concrete. So, you know, being able to charge more for you for something than your competitors can. And the case of Uber and Lyft and the food delivery apps, I haven't seen much evidence of that. You know, consumers en masse typically go with the cheapest option, which led to this nonstop promotional activity, which led to massive losses by pretty much every company in this space since they've been founded. Network effects, they're another thing we look for. And, you know, you could argue that Uber has developed network effects in terms of the number of drivers it has and the number of users. But again, it's not quite as strong as one would hope for, because drivers aren't Uber employees, which means they can drive for whatever service they want, and they do. And while many will lean into Uber because that's where the most riders are going to be, they'll also turn over to Lyft or Bolt or one of the other options if there's someone paying more per mile. And so, I mean, that's kind of what I was talking about back when we looked at these businesses, you know, a few years ago, that essentially they were entering into this kind of this. There was two people they were trying to please on both sides. And when you know, the drivers and the riders, and when you threw in food delivery, you were adding in a third. So you're talking about the drivers, the end consumer, and the restaurant. And you can't keep all those three happy and collect a tasty profit at the end. It just doesn't work. Someone had to get, you know, done over in that scenario. Yeah. And oftentimes it was drivers. And in the case of food delivery, it's restaurants and drivers.
And the customers who paid €15 for a sandwich to get delivered.
occasionally they would dare to actually charge the consumers what, you know, yeah, the value of what they were getting. So, yeah, I mean, I do think it's a little bit of a lie. And I do think that, you know, if Uber can continue to kind of muscle out Lyft and, you know, potentially they get to profitability, you know, I do think you could see returns in the stock eventually. But, you know, I don't think it's nearly worth the $150 billion that the company was, you know, trying to IPO at just a few years ago.
Yeah. The only thing I will say is, though, I don't think anyone's ever going back to calling a taxi. That's their one true economic moat, maybe.
Yeah, it's you know, there's something to be said for the innovations at Uber. Like, surge pricing is a good idea. You know, it genuinely does work. You know, if you want to get more drivers out when there's more demand, surge pricing makes sense. It was just this kind of consistent need to screw their drivers, essentially, because their model was predicated upon, you know, being a $100 billion business.
Yeah. Very good. Thanks, Roy.
No problem.
No worries. Anytime you're free. Moving on then. We read a recent study from the National Research Group, and it found that most Americans are likely to cut back on eating out, clothes, or even groceries rather than cancel their subscriptions to services like Amazon Prime and Netflix. Of the 2,500 participants, 51% said subscriptions now make up a significant portion of their monthly spending. On average, customers estimate they spend $135 a month and 18% of their monthly budget on subscriptions. Anne-Marie, I think it's fair to say that we're looking like we're heading into some form of recession in the near future. Obviously, I'm not going to ask you how severe it's going to be. If you would like to divulge that information, please. No, plead the fifth.
Yeah.
But there is going to be cutbacks of some sort across the board. With churn a major issue for these services, especially among streamers, I would have thought that they would have been the first to go once people tighten their belts. This study is kind of saying the opposite to that. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting result, but I suppose it's kind of a reminder that while we tend to think of discretionary spending as first to go, you do need to remember that people need some kind of little joy in their life. You know, kind of our thinking on this sometimes stems from that. You know, they keep doing all these interviews on the street in London and they keep interviewing Tories and they'll come up and say, oh, people will be able to afford houses if they cancel their Netflix subscriptions. And like, we all know that's not true. And so
it's like the avocado toast brigade, like.
Yeah, like, but we've seen this across like a number of categories, like cosmetic spending is on the rise, luxury items are pretty recession resistant, and even like cinema attendance is increasing in the last couple of months. And if we look back at 2008, we saw a very similar thing. So big splurges went away, like vacations, so that impacted airlines and hotels, but small splurges remained in place. Some of them even grew. So in the wake of the Great Recession, Netflix kind of became far more dominant, I think, than people were expecting. And it was kind of an opportunity for it to set itself apart from the competition and really prove its worth in the eyes of consumers. Of course, like, Netflix looked pretty different in 2008. You know, it was still a subscription model, but it was DVD based, and they were still sending them in the mail. But I suppose the fundamental premise was almost the same. You know, it's unlimited entertainment for a standard monthly fee. In 2008, Netflix subscriber growth increased 26% to 9.3 million, accelerating from the year before. And then it jumped even faster in 2009. It was up 31% to 12.3 million. At the same time, Blockbuster, which is, you know, the original name in DVD rental, saw its revenue fall by 20%, while same store sales growth dropped to negative 14%. So not to mention kind of all that debt that Blockbuster was carrying around at the time. So clearly, it seems to be this opportunity for you to prove yourself to consumers. And if they determine you have a good deal, it seems like they'll be happy.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
To keep you around.
Yeah, and I think, look, the headline sounds good. People are foregoing groceries for their Amazon Prime or Netflix subscriptions, but there is probably a more nuance to that. It's probably going to a less expensive grocery store instead of you canceling your Netflix and everything else. But we like a bit of sensationalism here at My Wall Street, you know?
Of course.
But you touched on something there about what is discretionary spending. And I suppose subscriptions are just an ever-present part of life for so many people now, more so than ever, I would imagine. So should we start to consider them non-discretionary spending? Like, what makes up discretionary spending these days?
Yeah, I don't know. Can we necessarily categorize it as non-discretionary? But I do think that, you know, we need to like maybe take into consideration what people prioritize in life when it comes to subscriptions. So I don't think we're going to see huge cancellations of Spotify or Apple Music. I think people find those too essential. I think most of the, like they're averaging probably like $10 a month. Like I think most people would find that in their budget. But as you said in the intro, consumers are spending like $135 a month on subscriptions. That seems a little bit high at the moment. So I would say that probably some more minor streaming services or subscription services may begin to feel a pinch here. I think we're going to see a concentration of power. And, you know, that's obviously going to benefit all of the big players. As like all of us have said for a while now, we've heard it from Emmett, we've heard it from Rory, probably the streaming wars is going to result in like three or four big name players because they are operating a huge scale. So they can make streaming worthwhile. You know, they can push towards some sort of margin. And I just think like this is the time when smaller streamers are going to get pushed out. Even like this week, we heard that Lionsgate is pulling its streaming service, which was called Stars. They rebranded it last month to Lionsgate Plus. It didn't do anything. So they're pulling it out of seven markets, which includes the vast majority of Europe and all of Japan. Their decision to exit these markets cost them about $215 million. And at the time of recording, Lionsgate Plus had about 27 million global subscribers, which is what, like a tenth of what Netflix is carrying. And this last quarter, they only saw an increase of 1 million subscribers, which isn't great. The vast majority of these subscribers are in the United States. And a lot of people end up with Star subscriptions because it comes with their cable. So it's not even people like seeking out this service necessarily. Apparently, like from what we've heard from management, this move is in an effort to streamline the media business ahead of a potential spinoff or a sale. So this is kind of what we saw coming. These minor players are not going to ever get to a scale in which streaming is worthwhile for them. So they're going to revert back to traditional methods. And we're seeing the exact same thing from Warner Brothers, which is maybe a little bit shocking because they control HBO, which is, you know, maybe the second or third best streaming service available. But they have repeatedly said, we are struggling to execute. We are struggling to turn a profit. And we know that we can be successful going to the box office. So we're going back there. We're going to start making big budget movies, you know, 5 or 6 years. We're going to movie theaters and they can show up on streaming services 8 weeks later. So I do think we're going to see a concentration of power here. And that's going to result from people maybe canceling subscription services that they don't get, you know, the bang for their buck from. So I'd say they're probably going to go away. And that's going to mean that, you know, we may see smaller studios coming back to Netflix or Amazon and agreeing to negotiate licensing rights, which again puts even more power in the hands of Netflix to go to consumers and say, hey, like now we have all these movies, like you should maintain your subscription. And I think we're going to see that, like not even just in streaming. I think we're going to see it across the board. Like the New York Times managed a subscriber beat this quarter. I think we were all surprised by that. But I think a lot of that comes from the fact the New York Times has gone out of its way to try and provide nuanced national coverage to Americans, especially on sports via The Athletic acquisition. And I'd say probably in the exact same quarter as the New York Times is doing well, probably localized papers are really struggling. And so, you know, I think if you can show people, hey, I can be the everyman, I have a product, you know, for any taste you have, I think it's much easier for people to justify that subscription. And, you know, you mentioned Amazon Prime in the intro, like you're getting 2-day shipping and you're getting like the B minus streaming service. So for most people, they're probably too comfortable, you know, with the 2-day shipping that it's not worthwhile them canceling.
Yeah. So then like 80% of America or something has an Amazon Prime subscription.
Yeah. And as they continue to add more like grocery stuff and day-to-day items, you know, it becomes less of, oh, I'll go on Amazon to buy something I don't really need. And it's more of like, no, I do have like my part of my weekly shop comes from Amazon, so I can't cancel Prime.
Yeah. A Prime subscription should be added to the consumer price index. Just thinking about it there.
Yeah, I think so. If I mean, like younger and younger people, like probably the vast majority of young people have a Prime subscription and are running a huge chunk of their spending through it. So yeah, like it's probably a necessity almost at this point.
You mentioned there just a bit of concentration around the top streamers and how you kind of see it culminating in maybe four or five big names. It's probably the bigger names, the Disney's, Apple, Amazon, Netflix are the ones that are going to win out just because they have the bigger war chest, more money to lose. I think Disney lost crazy amounts of money on Disney Plus this quarter.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it just comes from, I think a year ago, we were discussing how Netflix is far and away like the most efficient streaming service when it comes to spending. You know, we talked about Squid Game. That was made with like $20 million. That's insane when it comes to television. And it boiled down to something like they got 14 cents per view because so many people watch Squid Game. Like Netflix is just so good at producing a huge amount of content for the same budget as Disney. Whereas I think Disney's more kind of focused on spectacle. So yeah, I'd say we're going to see probably Netflix emerge, Amazon. And yeah, I think it's going to be probably Disney. And like maybe Apple is going to be the vine down there at the bottom with like some specialized stuff.
Yeah. So then I have a question for you. Out of all your subscriptions, what would you cancel first and what would you never cancel?
My Apple Music subscription, I don't think I could ever cancel because I genuinely use it every single day. So
yeah, I think you're a lunatic for using Apple Music over Spotify.
Sorry, what?
Yeah.
That's shocking.
I'll tell you why I use Apple Music. It's because I still have an active student subscription because there was a flaw in like our university system and it still has me registered as a student. So I get a discount. So I have Apple Music for that reason.
That's not going to get us kicked off Apple Podcasts. I don't know what.
Yeah, there you go.
I wonder what the whistleblower fee for something like that is.
Probably nothing.
Tim.
Yes.
Probably nothing.
So I have a nice discount going there. So I probably wouldn't cancel that. I don't know. I don't have many subscriptions. I have Amazon and... Again, because I have a student membership, I have Apple TV for free, so I don't pay for that. So
you shouldn't be divulging all this. This gets published on Apple Podcasts, like, you know?
Yeah.
There must be one person who works for Apple who listens to us.
There must be one person who listens to us.
Yeah.
It would have to maybe be Amazon Prime, simply because we're in like a weird transitionary period at the second where like Amazon.co.uk, some stuff they won't now deliver to Ireland.
You have to go from Germany or something.
Yeah, and we haven't yet properly gotten incorporated into that system. And so like half the time I want to buy something on Amazon and it won't ship to Ireland. So like I would maybe cancel that.
Yeah. Rory, what would you never cancel?
It would probably be my Spotify subscription, to be honest. I would also go on Amazon Prime because I do use a huge amount. I regularly like have a few pints in the pub and go back and like order a load of books I'm never going to read, and they just show up at my door.
Yeah, robot kettles or something.
I don't even remember ordering that Thai cookbook. Yeah.
Very good. Not too bad. So we have some very exciting news here at Stock Club. In 2 weeks' time, we'll be hosting Stock Club Live here in Dublin. This is going to be our first ever live podcast. And in it, Emmett, Rory, Emery, and I are going to look back on what has been a brutal year for the stock market. It might be a bit of a post-mortem. And looking ahead to 2023, I'm sure we're going to have some bold and predictably foolhardy predictions in place as well. This is taking place in the Herbert Park Hotel in Dublin on Wednesday, the 23rd of November. Tickets are limited and selling quickly. They're available right now. We're going to leave the link in the description, and they're going for £20 a head, which includes a couple of drinks, so you won't be too bored listening to us. For anyone listening from further afield, don't worry. We'll be planning more Stock Club events in 2023 outside of Dublin and even outside of Ireland. So watch this space. Rory and Marie, are you looking forward to going on stage, overcoming your fear of public speaking?
Where are the international ones? I know we have a big audience in Bermuda.
Bermuda.
Great, yeah.
We're like the number one podcast in Bermuda.
100%. We might get some tax breaks if we go out there, is that?
Yeah, we should start moving the business out there. We should just move.
We should all move to podcast on the beach. Yeah, I could do with that.
My partner recently got a job offer from Bermuda and she turned it down. So this would be a massive, that'd be a real swerve of me if I then just like, oh, I'm moving.
She got a job offer from the country of Bermuda, or the company was just based there?
I don't know. I don't even know what she does.
There's a lot of companies based in Bermuda, Emery. We could be based in Bermuda. We don't even know.
How are we feeling for it? I have not received like the firm questions of what we're going to be talking about yet.
I haven't even been asked to do it, so. That's just the first I heard about it.
That's not true. I told you when you came back from vacation, the first call.
We're supposed to be selling this here, okay?
Because you came back from vacation and the first call we had, I was like, oh, I'll break this to Rory so that he knows and he can start mentally preparing for this ask.
I remember that. Anyway.
Rory doesn't like preparation. He comes alive on the stage. That's what happened.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it would be kind of that year in review. We've done a few of them before. I'll have to go back over the old episodes and get all our awful predictions out again.
How bad were your guys' predictions? Mine's kind of fine from the beginning of the year.
I don't know. I can't even remember.
I genuinely don't even remember what my prediction was. You know, okay. One of those years.
Yeah. You got your Beyond Meat one right eventually, didn't you?
Eventually, yeah.
Yeah. All comes good in the end. Okay. So for more amazing Beyond Meat predictions, 23rd November in the Herbert Park Hotel in Dublin. We'll see you there. Moving on to mailbag then. We got a few questions in around stock-based compensation. It's kind of been a hot topic of late, especially with declining valuations in the tech sector. Rory, could you elaborate a bit on what exactly is stock-based compensation and why it can be an issue for investors?
Sure, yeah. Stock-based compensation, SBC, also known as employee options or ESOP, it's just a way for companies to reward their employees through kind of equity ownership in the company. That's, you know, opposed to, say, how one usually gets compensated with a salary or, you know, monetary bonus payment. These aren't, by the way, to be confused with options that are available to investors. So, you know, they're not traded on any exchange. They're given as like benefits to employees. And I suppose the kind of number one kind of use case for them has been as employee retention. So a way to attract and retain talent. So, you know, you think of a lot of technology startups, there's plenty of stories out there about, you know, some guy who joined Meta or Facebook, you know, when it was starting out and basically became like a billionaire just through kind of his startup options. So small startups typically use stock options to kind of attract employees that maybe they wouldn't be able to attract in a more competitive market when they're going up against kind of bigger technology companies with kind of bigger budgets. Of course, big technology companies also offer stock options the majority of the time, which can be a way to attract employees, obviously, as well as retain employees. The retention element of it is because options usually vest over a period of time. So, you know, if you have a large number of options vesting, you're less likely to leave the company knowing that you would lose those options. Another reason, and some people are a bit skeptical of this, is that it aligns employees with management in terms of, you know, trying to make the company succeed. So the better the company does, the more valuable your options are. Now, like in terms of what this means for investors, obviously there's benefits to the business if they're not spending cash on employees' wages. And that's particularly true of kind of companies that don't have a lot of cash. So companies that are, you know, losing money or companies that are, you know, still starting out. A lot of these times these companies have, you know, they're pretty cash poor and share rich because, you know, when your company's not worth anything, you can print as many shares you want. No one's going to stop you. But, you know, what happens is that it can end up having, you know, quite a big impact when businesses start kind of using this in lieu of cash when the company's not growing. You know, what we tend to think is, a lot of companies will kind of use this as kind of like free currency. So, yeah, we don't have the cash to pay employees, you know, the millions of dollars that we need to pay them. So we're just going to give them stock options. And obviously, you know, that's not the case. It isn't free currency. You know, money doesn't come from nowhere. It has to come from somewhere. And where it most likely comes from is in the form of these shares, which in terms of a public company, you know, companies can be spending millions, maybe billions on this stock-based compensation. That's going to end up falling down to very much the bottom line in terms of there's going to be a lot more shares out there. And that it ends up diluting current shareholders. So SBC, you know, it's kind of one of these things that people argue about. On one side, there's people who say, you know, if you talk about, like Warren Buffett has a very good quote, which says, you know, if options aren't a form of compensation, then what are they? If compensation isn't an expense, then what is it? And if expenses shouldn't go into the calculation of earnings, then where in the world should it go? So there's people who kind of say that companies use stock-based compensation to kind of hide what's really going on in the business, that, you know, they're basically paying a lot of employees, which is a huge cost with shares rather than cash. And that's making their bottom line look a bit better. And that's deceiving employees. And at the end of the day, it's diluting shareholders. There's another, you know, the other way of looking at it is that, you know, it's a way for companies to grow the business without the use of cash. And that's an important, especially when companies don't have a huge amount of cash. So there's arguments on both sides. I would say that, you know, if you're really keen on finding out, like, is it going to impact your investment, you probably have to look a little bit deeper and see, you know, how is the, you know, nearly all companies use some form of SBC out there. You really have to go and see, like, how much is that actually impacting the business. There's loads of, you know, cases out there where companies have done the absolute worst thing. And probably Twitter is probably the most famous example where, you know, back in 2017, I think it was, they were spending something like 29% of revenue on share-based compensation. And this was a company that wasn't making any profit at that point. So you're talking about like hundreds of millions of dollars going to pay staff when the company wasn't making any money. And in order for investors to recoup that, the company was going to have to grow like super fast in order to just make up that loss. There's other companies, you know, I think that you go and you read into their proxy statements, they're very much targeted. You know, the share-based compensation is based on performance, based on key metrics. If you can see it being based on key metrics that are long-term metrics rather than short-term metrics, all the better. But yeah, I mean, there's no one right answer to it. It's really done on a case-by-case basis of whether it's kind of a good thing or a bad thing, or whether investors should be really worried about it or they should really worry that much about it.
Yeah, very nice. So it depends. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Good stuff. All right, thanks for that.
Like most things in this world, there's no just straight up answer.
It's a nice gray area. Okay. Right, moving on then. We're going to finish off with the elevator pitches. Anne-Marie, what company have you been looking at recently?
I am checking back in with a company that I have pitched twice before, but I'm really interested in them, which is
Anne-Marie, could you get us a new company?
No, I cannot.
We're going for the hat trick.
Because I really like it, and I was kind of waiting to see how it was going to do in these economic times. No, it's NerdWallet. Do you remember NerdWallet?
Oh, I remember NerdWallet,
too. Yeah. I like it. Just a refresher, they provide information that educates users in making financial decisions. You know, if you Google what
you
credit card is
right for
me, it comes
up. You definitely
forgot
about this part of the podcast until we started recording, didn't you?
No. So I've been watching them because I think an interesting kind of pivot for NerdWallet is they help banks like advertise essentially or go and find new users for their products. And because advertising is having such a hard time at the minute with iOS 14.5 and all that stuff, I think NerdWallet's like value proposition to banks has increased substantially in terms of like, this is a great place to find high value customers. And that was kind of proven true in their latest quarterly report that was published this week. They delivered 45% year-over-year revenue growth and generated $14.5 million of adjusted EBITDA, which is pretty good. This is their first quarter being profitable. And then they had 19 million average monthly unique users, which was up 11% year-over-year, which I liked because the last couple quarters we'd seen that metric stall a little bit, I think, as, you know, conditions kind of deteriorated in terms of the economy. People got a bit nervous. But yeah, I was pretty impressed with this quarter. One thing, sales and marketing costs are still climbing. That was something that came up in their first look and their second look. But I do think it's them trying to set up themselves as being like the end all be all. You go there for financial advice rather than being reliant on Google, which I do like that idea. They're trying to set themselves up that way because, you know, Google can change the algorithm and it could all be over. I love their CEO, Tim Chen. He's the founder. He owns a huge part of the business. He seems super nice. Stock is down 47% this year. They're just about at a $1 billion market cap, so really small, but it's a very like mission-driven business. I really like it. It's, you know, it would be an easy add to a portfolio because it's an easy company to feel good about. So, yeah. Yeah.
Well, if they want to be the number one place to go to for financial advice, they'll have to beat out this podcast as well.
Well, when was the last time we reviewed a credit card?
Well, this is also not financial advice. I think we have to say that, don't we?
Yeah.
Rory, what's your elevator pitch for us?
I'm looking at a very, very boring business called Broadridge Financial Solutions. The ticker symbol is BOR. It's one of those businesses that I suspect most people have never heard of, but you've probably interacted with at some point in your life, particularly if you're listening to this podcast. And that's because Broadridge Financial is the biggest player in proxy and interim communications. To try and explain the business in a very quick nutshell, most people who hold shares in the United States and further abroad don't actually hold them. You know, there's very few people who actually have share certificates in their cabinets anymore. What actually happens is that you have an online broker, digital broker, and the broker owns those shares on your behalf. So you're what's called a kind of beneficial owner. And that causes a big problem because companies, mutual funds, ETFs, etc., they need to communicate with their investors. And, you know, it's hard for them to figure out who the actual investor that they need to communicate with is. So Broadridge essentially handles all these types of communications with end investors. It's kind of a third party in between the broker and the company or the mutual fund that ends up getting, you know, all those, everything from, you know, reports, proxy materials for voting, anything that the company needs to disclose to investors, all kind of runs through Broadridge. And, you know, they're pretty much the kind of only game in town, which is a nice place to be. Pretty much every brokerage out there uses them. And there's kind of some very kind of old laws that essentially makes it impossible for brokers to kind of swerve this. And there's minimum amounts that they have to pay for their services. So it's kind of one of those very, I suppose, safe and solid businesses. It's the company that brings in around, you know, 5.5, 5.7 billion last year, grows, you know, somewhere between 10 and 15% a year. They kind of, you know, they kind of got a boost during the pandemic with this kind of rise in retail investors. And so I was kind of, watching, expecting them to get smashed in the most recent quarter, because as we know, retail investing has really fallen off a cliff in the last couple of months. But actually it wasn't too bad. They did miss, but not by much, and they've maintained guidance going forward. So yeah, I'm digging a bit deeper into Broadridge Financial Solutions.
Very good. That's a very Peter Lynch-esque stock, isn't it? Boring.
Yeah, but... I'm actually also looking at Crown Holdings, which is the new name for Crown Cork and Seal, which you wrote about extensively in this book.
you must be having great sleep these days.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, lads. That's it for today's show. Remember, if you have any questions you'd like answered or elevator pitches you'd like us to tackle, make sure to get in touch. You can find us on Twitter. That's at My Wall Street HQ. On TikTok, that's at My Wall Street, or simply just email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. If you're enjoying the show, make sure to tell your friends about us. And don't forget to leave a review for us on whatever podcast platform you listen to us on. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll talk to you next week.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.